Part Two of The Fire by Francesca, read by Dodificus. And then what happened? Jim knew that Dr. Arenberg was trying to get him to stop snivelling, to put himself together, to end this pathetic display. But he couldn't stop. He was miserable and shamed, and his misery and shame were compounded by the fact that he wasn't entirely sure if he was feeling regret or loss. Because he did feel loss, and oddly lost now. He desperately regretted it had ever happened. He desperately regretted it had ever ended. Dr. Arenberg sighed, and Jim could hear his chair creaking. Did you reach climax? Behind the protective cover of his hands, his face contorted. He sobbed, nodded. Did you penetrate him? His head shot up. Despite his mortification, he was appalled. No. No, of course not. I would never. I wouldn't. But who could say any more? Wasn't anything possible now? I wouldn't do that, he managed, finally, praying fervently that he was telling the truth. All right, Dr. Arenberg said slowly. Are you a homosexual? No, he replied, but he felt less certain of this. He didn't think he was, but the truth was that he'd never been much interested in sex. Too obsessed with getting the fuck out of Cascade, away from his father, away from himself. Jimmy Ellison had had a few haphazard girlfriends back in high school, but somewhere deep down, he despised them for wanting to be with him. He didn't even want to be with him. He didn't even want to be there. And maybe part of him had wondered if his relative disinterest in women didn't indicate homosexual tendencies on his part. But he'd never had time to explore the issue. And he wouldn't, he determined suddenly, stubbornly. Not if it meant this. Not if it were in any way connected to this. Dr. Arenberg sounded noncommittal. What about your childhood? Were you a victim of molestation? No, Jim replied. Were you close to your mother? Yeah, I was, but she and my father got divorced when I was 8. She died a couple of years later. Dr. Arenberg frowned. So you were raised exclusively by your father? Jim found himself laughing hollowly. Sort of. I mean, you could say that. Except it's not true. I was basically raised by everybody in town except my father. Meaning what exactly? Sally, our housekeeper, probably did most of the day-to-day stuff. Like when we were sick. We? Dr. Arenberg interrupted. My brother and me, Jim explained. Stephen, my younger brother. Dr. Arenberg nodded. And then there were a whole lot of other people. Teachers, friends of the family, coaches. Men? Dr. Arenberg asked. Some of them. Yeah, I mean, I was pretty close with my football coach. But there was nothing inappropriate in that relationship? Jim frowned. No. In fact, he wasn't entirely sure about that either. Somewhere in the back of his mind, there was something unpleasant associated with his memory of Bud. He closed his eyes and thought hard. Not, he heard himself amending, that I remember anyway. So it's possible. He opened his eyes and saw that Dr. Arenberg was peering at him intently. Yes, he admitted, it's possible. Because you see, it could make all the difference, Dr. Arenberg mused, leaning back in his chair and steepling his fingers. Frankly speaking, Lieutenant, I'm inclined to say that you've had a very upsetting but anomalous experience. Consider the facts of your story. You had just been through a harrowing experience, saving the boy from the burning building, and the adrenaline rush alone provides an explanation. It's not at all surprising that you should have found yourself sexually aroused. You had, quite literally, experienced excitement. But what he'd felt hadn't been entirely physical, Jim wanted to protest. He'd felt an emotional connection to the boy, had felt what some sick part of him still wanted to call love. Then, consider the fact that the refuge you found was in a vault used to store opiates, Dr. Arenberg continued meditatively. As you yourself thought at the time, it's entirely possible that some residue of the drug lowered your natural defences and caused you to connect your adrenaline-based state of arousal to the stimulus of the boy. Consider further that, having just risked your own life to save his, you were probably feeling quite attached to him, affectionate even. Jim realized that he was nodding agreement. Attached, yes. Affectionate, yes. What he really felt was that he would die for the boy. He'd already proved he'd risk damnation for him. And then certainly you would have been feeling a rush of power. Having just saved the boy, you might reasonably have believed that you owned him. And you said he, to the best of your recollection, did not protest sexual contact? To the best of your recollection, Jim mentally translated the phrase as, "We don't trust the perceptions of child molesters. He wanted it, officer. Really, he did." Jim felt sick. He didn't seem to. I don't find that surprising either. He was most certainly in shock. Possibly he didn't realize what was going on. Possibly he did realize, but felt he couldn't refuse you. He may have been consumed with gratitude. A lump rose in his throat as he remembered how the boy had tried to comfort him. Everything's gonna be okay. Everything's gonna be just fine. In any case, the circumstances here are quite unique, so I'm inclined to tell you not to worry. But that, of course, changes if you yourself were a victim of molestation. The chances of this being an isolated incident then decrease dramatically. Jim felt sharp, severe, rising panic. Please, Doc, tell me what to do. I'll do anything. Anything. Dr. Arenberg's face grew kindly and reassuring. Well then, the first thing you need to do is to calm down. As I say, I'm unconvinced that you're a chronic molester, and I have vast experience in this area. You're a very young man. Dr. Arenberg leaned over, checked his notes, and added, Only 21, and you were in a highly stressful and unusual situation. You're clearly remorseful, and you're seeking help. I'm inclined to think that this was an unfortunate but isolated incident. Except maybe he wasn't entirely remorseful. Except maybe he had been molested and he couldn't remember. Except the whole incident had scarred him deeply, carving what felt like a huge, gaping hole inside him, started him craving for something terrifying and nameless. Dr. Arenberg wasn't inclined to think he was a chronic molester. Not good enough. He would see to it that it wasn't so. He would exert every ounce of his will. He would dampen himself down, hold himself back, bind himself tightly, now and forever. Amen. Part 3. Cascade, Washington, 2000. I wandered distractedly through the hallways of Major Crimes, feeling like I'd been unexpectedly paroled from a life sentence. Sandberg hadn't known what he'd been asking me to do back there, and if it hadn't been for Sandberg, I probably wouldn't have done it. It was tempting fate, but fuck, I seemed to have sent fate, bitch-slapped and handcuffed, back to whatever hellhole she'd crawled out of. I probably ought to have just been grateful, cashed in my chips and split. But somehow, having tempted fate once, I felt compelled to do it again. I was tottering between elation and disappointment. Elation at the prospect of having vanquished this fucking thing. And a growing sense of disappointment over, well, time wasted. Life wasted. My life. Because maybe Dr. Arenberg had been right. Maybe it had just been an isolated thing, a one-time only nightmare. Maybe Sandberg's theory of pheromones was on the money. Maybe some inexplicable, random, unrepeatable set of conditions had come into play. Maybe I'd closed myself down, held myself back, fucked myself up, all for nothing. The idea, once it came, had to be tested. Gradually, cautiously, I began to open myself up to sensation, wanting to know if I was still manning a defensive post in a long-abandoned war. Not like it would be the first time. And so I wandered around the building, stopping in to visit the new, young, uniformed officers. Nothing. Going down to chat with the high school dropouts who fixed the precinct's patrol cars. Nothing. Even visiting the secretarial pool on the third floor, which stopped the PD gossip mill cold and brought lots of flustered women to their feet. I was looking for someone in particular as a sort of final test. Margie Kramer, who had two beautiful sons, 9 and 12, with short, dark, curly hair and huge green eyes. The boys weren't there right now, but their silver-framed pictures were in their customary position on Margie's desk. I inquired about them politely, noting that it had been ages since I'd seen them. Had it been the Christmas party? The annual picnic? The mayor's Easter egg hunt? Margie enthused about how well they were doing, how Robert had won the science prize for his year for designing some sort of computer program, how Sam was beginning to show real talent for the clarinet, the staggering amounts they both ate, and how they'd both grown like weeds in consequence. And this gave me an excuse to pick up the pictures and study them, consciously, deliberately entertaining thoughts that I'd once forcibly pushed away. 12-year-old Robert was the right age, but it was the younger one, Sam, whose picture captured me. Robert was already growing angular with puberty, but Sam's face still had that childhood sweetness I remembered, and sometimes still craved. I made myself look hard, forced myself not to turn away, and found that, yeah, I still felt something. But not for Sam, who seemed like a good kid, but was definitely a kid. I couldn't, even in my most depraved fantasies, imagine myself feeling passion for him. The idea, even as I forced myself to have it, was totally fucking ludicrous. He sparked nothing. But Sam looked just enough like the boy who had destroyed me, that I felt consumed with regret, nostalgia, loss. Maybe it had been a one-time-only thing, but it still had its power, still had an impact. I murmured something tactful and put Sam's picture carefully back on the desk. Margie beamed proudly at me and thanked me. And I smiled at her and withdrew, more confused than ever. Because it just couldn't be this simple. Not again. It couldn't be a simple matter of packing my bags, getting on the helicopter and going home. It hadn't turned out to be so simple last time either, though God knows it had seemed simple enough at the time. War's over, Allison. Pack it in. You're demobbed. Oh, and by the way, you've got a time bomb of ticking sensors within you waiting to go off. And this was a hell of a lot more complicated than that. Exposure was deadlier, too. If Sandberg had actually published his fucking book, I could probably have survived it. But this? Never. No fucking way. So 19 years of preventative measures couldn't have been for nothing, right? In fact, it hadn't been for nothing. I was almost sure of that. I remembered staring at Sam's picture I'd seen another picture like that in the not-too-distant past. I was nearly sure of it. And that picture had stirred my gut and my lust and reminded me of the sad, sick fuck that I was. I stopped short in the hallway, trying to remember, needing to remember. It couldn't have been that long ago. But I was too damn good at forgetting now, and the damn picture just wouldn't come. Sighing, I went to get myself a cup of coffee and maybe a muffin. I was on my second cup when the door opened and Sandberg fell in, looking both exhausted and exhilarated. "Finished saving the world?" I asked dryly. "Oh man, you don't know the half of it." Sandberg crossed the room, yanked the carafe out of the machine, and poured coffee into an old chipped mug that said, erroneously, "Kiss me, I'm Irish." "But yeah, we did it. And the world is well and truly saved, my brother." "Leo talked?" I pressed. Sandberg sank down in the chair next to me, grinning broadly. "Hell yeah, he sang like the proverbial canary. You, Jim, old buddy, are just the master." Leo recited in full, told us everything we wanted to know and a few things we didn't. We had to stop him eventually. He must have really scared the shit out of him. So I took the confession to Simon. Simon took it to Martin. Martin agreed and called Leo's lawyer with a deal. "A good deal, Jim. The right deal." I nodded, happy that Sandberg was happy. "So what was the sob story?" Sandberg groaned. "You don't want to know. Parents are divorcing, there's a major custody battle, they're using him as a pawn, kids acting out, all the usual late 20th century angst." Sandberg shook his head and took a sip of his coffee. "Still, though, I can't help but empathize." I snorted at this. "Sandberg, your parents were never married. There was never any issue of custody. You weren't used as an alimony pawn. And from what I can see, you never acted out in your life." Sandberg gave an evil little chuckle. "Sure I did. What the fuck do you think I'm doing here, hanging out with you?" I laughed helplessly at this. The kid had a point. In fact, he seemed to be sending Naomi a lot of little presents lately. Cascade PD mugs, t-shirts, sweatshirts, pens. Just in case maybe Naomi was having the occasional daydream that her one and only precious boy had become an accountant. "Seriously, Jim," Sandberg mused, stretching himself backwards over his chair and staring thoughtfully at the ceiling. "That's a horrible age he's at. You can make a lot of mistakes right about then, especially if your parents aren't on the ball. You're not a kid, and you're not even a teenager. You're in that weird no man's land between childhood and adolescence." 14 is adolescence, Sandberg." "Nah, be honest, man. Not for a guy. Girls are women already at 14. Girls are, like, already smarter than we ever get." Sandberg lifted his head and showed him a lopsided grin. "Guys are dopes at 14. Guys are just years behind." "You were in college at 16, I objected, and something subtle in Sandberg's face changed. "Well, yeah, but I was still a dope, Jim. I was just a dope who was going to college. Big whoop. Truth be told, I'm still pretty much a dope," Sandberg added with a hapless shrug. "Except now, I'm a dope who's at peace with himself. So hey, that's progress, right?" I stared at my partner, my friend, my guide, the dope who was now at peace with himself. "Whatever you say, Chief." "Well, that's what I say," Sandberg said. "Put it this way, a little luck at the right moment can make all the fucking difference in life, Jim, believe you me. Just the tiniest little bit of luck at the right time can change your whole life forever." Sandberg sounded like he knew what he was talking about. I thought back to my own early adolescence, and yeah, maybe that was right about the time my mother died. Bud had seen me through the divorce, but he'd been killed before my mother passed. Maybe if he'd still been around then, things would have been different for me. Thought of Bud brought out a quick whiplash of guilt. Bud, of course, hadn't molested me at all, and I couldn't believe I'd ever thought it of him, God rest his soul. Then again, of course, unlike Bud, I'd done it. I was actually guilty. I pushed that thought away and looked over at my partner, who was leaning tiredly on his elbow, sipping coffee. He'd been lucky Leo's good luck charm today. Leo had Sandberg, and I'd had Bud, at least for a little while. I wondered who Sandberg had had, and so I asked him. A smile ghosted across Sandberg's face at the question. Ugh, that's sort of complicated. It's a really weird story. Sometimes I even think I imagined it, you know? Yeah, I do know, I replied. Because hell, I did. Sometimes I think I made my whole fucking life up. Sandberg nodded sympathetically. Yeah, exactly. Some things are too weird to be real. It was a million, zillion years ago anyway. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But let's just say that my good luck eventually brought me to Rania, which brought me to Burton, which brought me to you, which brings me here, and... Sandberg stopped short and sat up straight in his chair, his eyes going theatrically wide. Hey, did I say good luck? I wadded up my napkin and threw it at him. You pig. That's officer pig to you, asshole, Sandberg said and got up out of his chair. He took his mug to the sink and washed it out, which none of the rest of us ever did. Christ, he was such a boy scout underneath that soft exterior. All right, back to the mines. What, you're not done yet? Well, Sandberg equivocated, I'm sort of done. I just want to see it through, see where the kid landed. See if I can get him kept here tonight, rather than sent off to Humberford. I rolled my eyes. You're after my Cop of the Year award. Confess it. Sandberg grinned. Watch your back, boyo. He stopped by my chair and peered at me intently for a moment. While I'm being a saint, is there anything I can do for you? You look really beat. I am, yeah, I admitted. I got up on the wrong side of the bed anyway, and that interrogation didn't help my mood none. Sensory spikes? Sandberg asked, dropping his voice to a whisper. My problems weren't sensory. God knows, in the broader scheme of things, most of my fucking problems weren't sensory. I sighed wearily. I didn't want Sandberg to know about this. I was lucky he put up with me as it was. Yeah, I lied. A couple. Nothing major. I think Leo might have been wearing too much aftershave. I didn't smell anything, Sandberg confessed. But then again, I wouldn't, would I? Sandberg turned and dropped his hands onto my shoulders and began to massage them. Something he'd done probably a million times before in the 4 years we'd known each other. Except I had never been so open before. I'd never experienced life so unfiltered. And suddenly I jerked under his hands, gasping, because the sensation was damn near unbearable. I felt like I'd been electrocuted, shot through with electricity, senses fried to burning, and my nose was full of the scent of fire, the acrid sting of smoke, my ears full of Persian chattering, the frantic beating of horses' hooves, the smell of roasting. I leapt out of my chair and backed across the room. Sandberg stared at me and slowly raised his hands. He looked worried, but when he spoke, his tone was defensive. Hey, what? What did I do? I stared back at him, frantically doing math in my head. I was 41. Sandberg was nearly 31, which meant we were just about 10 years apart. If I'd been 21 in 1980, then Sandberg had been... No. No, no, no. Jim, man, quit it. Just, whatever you're doing there, just fucking quit it right now. I took a deep breath and tried to speak normally, still keeping my distance. Sorry, muscle cramp. It had to be a muscle cramp. Anything sensory and Sandberg would be on me like white on rice. Sandberg raised a suspicious eyebrow. Must have been a fucking hell of a muscle cramp. It was, yeah, I replied, and made a big show of rotating my shoulder. I think maybe I'll go home, take a long hot shower. I'll make dinner too, I added as an afterthought, as an offering. Give you a bit of a break tonight, or you're making the world safe for democracy. Sandberg looked skeptical. It was your turn anyway. Oh, shit, it was. Well, there you go. Guess I'll go to it then. Pasta okay? Pasta's fine, Sandberg sighed and turned for the door, then paused with his hand on the knob and peered narrowly at me. Muscle cramp? You better not be fucking with me. Not after, you know, everything. You'd tell me if there was something really wrong, right? Right, I managed. God, please, but I'd never, ever fucked with him. I debated the matter frantically on the drive home, convincing myself that it was impossible, inevitable, impossible. It couldn't possibly have been Sandberg in that fire. Of course it was Sandberg in that fire. What other American boy would have been in Afghanistan in 1981? And face it, after the whole dissertation fiasco, I could sure imagine Naomi's hand in this mess. Trust that woman to put her son smack into the middle of an international military crisis. Naomi Sandberg all over. In fact, I seem to remember that the boy's mother did in fact have red hair. In the vault, time, and my memory of it, had passed with languid, sweet slowness. But afterwards, the film of my memory went into super fast play. A crowd of people, the blackened facade of the cooling buildings, me carrying the boy out, holding him in my arms, not wanting to let go of him. A screaming woman in a singed skirt. Red hair? I couldn't really remember. Rushing out of the crowd and claiming him joyfully. The agony of letting him go. Answering questions for the military police. Trying to remember who the fuck I was. Yeah, right. Christoph Schmidt. Mathematics, Polytechnic, DDR. I was just passing and heard the boy screaming, sir. One last glimpse of him, head turned back toward me as he disappeared into the crowd. His face was certainly burned into my memory, and I tried hard to compare it to Sandberg's. Nobody looks much like they do when they're children, but sure, the basic features were the same. Dark hair, thick curls, blue eyes, the shape of his mouth. Christ, what did it mean if it was true? Finally, there was just one thought left spinning in my head as I parked the car. Sandberg had said that his piece of good luck had brought him to Rania. So why Rania? What brought a 16-year-old dope called Blair Sandberg to Rania University? Sure, the Burton collection was there, in the Rare Books Library. Hell, I knew more about the Rania Rare Books Library than any sane man ought to know. But Sandberg as much as admitted that he didn't know that at the time. So why Rania University out of all the places where a brilliant 16-year-old could have gone? Why not Harvard or Princeton or Berkeley? Berkeley was much more Sandberg's speed, and Sandberg had been born in California. He could have gone there for almost nothing. The answer whispered in my mind even as I tried to push it away. Because Rainier University was in Cascade, Washington. That thought brought me dazedly up the steps and into the loft. Because if that were true, If Sandberg had really come to Cascade pursuing Christophe, well then, that was... I sat down in the armchair and started laughing, vaguely aware that tears were welling up in my eyes. That meant that everything was a sentinel thing. Every fucking little thing. I'd sent Blaise Sandberg to Rainier. Rainier had offered him Burton. Burton had sent him right back to me. And me, after the fire, I'd broken down, sought psychiatric help, requested a transfer. I hadn't wanted to be in the city, in the country, in the region. I'd been running from him, from myself, from the torture of memory. Get me the fuck off this continent, I'd said, and the army, in their infinite wisdom, pronounced me cured and obliged me. What do you think about South America, they said. You seem to have a real talent for languages. How's your Spanish, they said. Here, take this map. Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, Peru. Within Peru, Lima, Callao, Huánuco, Pucallpa, Yurimaguas, Iquitos. Forget the Mujahideen. This ain't a holy war. It's a guerrilla war. No more opium. Now we're talking cocaine. From Arabia to the Incas in a hop, skip and a jump. Sandberg had sent me running to South America, and I'd sent him to Rainier's rare book library, each of us to discover sentinels in our own way, as suited our respective talents. That meant that we'd been dancing around each other for years and years, Sandberg and me, whirling around each other like orbiting planets, together even when we were apart. Together, maybe, before we had ever met, before we had ever known each other. I snuffled some teary laughter into my hand, then wiped my eyes with my sleeve. Going into the kitchen, I filled a pot with water for the pasta. As I carried the water to the stove, my eye caught a homey little framed tapestry Sandberg must have put up in the kitchen. In the 4 years that Sandberg had lived there, he often brought in things that I noticed, but never really noticed. Wall hangings, oven mitts, throw pillows, that sort of thing. I flicked the stove on and then bent closely to look at the tapestry in question. A thin, overhanging tree with twisty, vine-like branches. Focusing my sight, I saw the tree was bearing tiny little green fruits. Grapes, maybe, or olives. I couldn't decide, and it didn't matter much. I went to take a long, hot shower, and even though my muscle cramp had been totally fictional, I came out feeling better, looser, more relaxed. I was beginning to see the upside to the situation. If everything was this out of control, if I was on some kind of relentless train of destiny, well then, maybe I should just calm down and see where the train stopped next. The water was boiling now, and I put in a pound of pasta, then turned my attention to making the sauce. I liked cooking, always had. Liked the kind of concentration it required. Liked the blend of precision and inspiration. Liked, well, I suppose I also liked the sensory aspect of it. Experimenting with smells and tastes and textures. So I chopped tomatoes and garlic and basil, and added a little sugar and olive oil, and some other things, letting myself get a little lost in the process. When Sandberg finally came home, he looked beat, but seemed to perk a little at the smell of fresh everything. "Ooh," he said, carelessly hooking his coat by the door and coming into the kitchen to peer into the saucepan. "You're making the good stuff." "Nothing but the best for the cop of the year," I said, leaving it deliberately ambiguous as to whether I meant him or me. Sandberg grinned at me, and then went into the bathroom, presumably to wash up. I stirred my sauce meditatively, wondering whether it needed more onion or more sugar, wondering if I could just let everything go, just let things remain the way they were. After all, we lived together for 4 years, more or less happily. Did it really matter that maybe, we'd met before, 19 years ago, and spent a couple of hours together? God, I was such a stinking, stinking liar. I threw down my wooden spoon in disgust, ignoring the splatter it made across the countertop. Spent a couple of hours together. Yeah, if that was what had happened, I wouldn't even think about it. I'd been skirting the line as it was. It was probably the one thing I didn't tell Sandberg, the anthropologist. And thankfully, it was the one thing nobody else could tell him about. The only evidence was buried somewhere near the bottom of some classified Cold War CIA files. Young operative snaps, quits, is reassigned. Yeah, they'd trained me for the Cold War, but they'd used me in the drug war, and probably only two or three people, even in the CIA, even in the Rangers, remembered that I'd ever been in Afghanistan at all. Most days, I managed not to remember either. Before, when I did remember, I could always tell myself that it was none of Sandberg's business. Who knew that it would turn out to be his business? Christ, was everything Blair Sandberg's business after all? Was that the ultimate cosmic joke here? But no way could I keep living with him, working with him, hanging out with him, touching him. 'Cause God knows I could never keep my hands off him, and that should have told me something. Without telling him, this thing was explosive. It'd be like living with a ticking time bomb. Sandberg came out of the bathroom with a towel slung around his neck, looking cleaner and brighter and much more cheerful. So, food up yet? Yep, I said, switching the pasta off and picking the pot up to drain it. The Last Supper. I made us each large bowls of pasta and went so far as to break out the best bottle of red wine we had in the house. Sandberg looked at me strangely, but said nothing. Maybe, he figured, this was my way of apologizing for being a jerk today. Or maybe this was my way of congratulating him on his victory. It was both, but it was more than that. Much, much more. And so we ate together peaceably while he filled me in on the fate of Leonardo DiCaprio. Thanks to Sandberg, Leo was going to avoid adult prison entirely, going straight from the CPD jail to the juvie facility. Thanks to Sandberg, Leo's guilty plea was going to be heard in a juvie court, where they gave a shit about things like family dysfunction and considered them as mitigating factors in sentencing. Lucky, lucky Leo. I listened closely, nodding and grunting approval in all the appropriate places. Mainly, I stared down at my plate of vermicelli and ate, but every so often I glanced up at him, trying to make all the pieces square together. If I let myself go hazy, I could so easily forget, the connection between the man in front of me and the boy over whom I'd ruined my life. And so I stole glances at him, trying to forge the connection for once, and for all in my head, checklisting the blue eyes, the shape of his face, the smooth, vaguely olive complexion, the nimble fingers as they gripped the stem of the wine glass. "So all right," Sandberg said abruptly, dropping his fork into his empty bowl with a clink and shoving it away across the table. "Now you talk." I jerked my head up, my heart suddenly pounding nervously. You obviously, I mean... There's something going on here," Sandberg finished finally, "and I want to know what it is." I took a deep breath and nodded. "Okay, yeah, I have something to tell you." Sandberg looked at me encouragingly. "Okay, I just found out today that I, 'cause see, I thought, shit, I don't know how to say this, I confessed. Just spit it out, Sandberg advised helpfully. I groaned. It's just really complicated. I think you'd better, brace yourself. Sandberg frowned at me for a moment, then picked up his wine glass and chugged the rest of his red wine down. Right, he said, putting the glass down again. I'm braced. Hit me. I was only about halfway through the story when Sandberg finally lost it and went flying out of his chair, yelling, "Fuck! Fuck! Fuck, fuck, fuck!" The panic inside me blossomed, bloomed, grew huge. Sandberg, I. Fuck! Sandberg was doing fast laps around the living room now, waving his hands around like the air was suddenly full of giant vampire bats. Oh, holy fucking fuck! I moaned and covered my face with my hands. There wasn't any point in continuing the story. He'd got the key points all right. He'd figured out the rest. I rubbed my aching eyes, vaguely wondering how the hell we were going to recover from this, while Sandberg ran around the loft and conjugated the word fuck in increasingly inventive ways. Bang. He'd gone into his room and slammed the door. Privacy didn't seem to help him any. He was just in there, circling madly, talking to himself. Fuck me. I can't fucking believe this. It's just too fucking much. What the fuck was he doing in Afghanistan? And then Sandberg was yelling at me through the closed door. What the fuck were you doing in Afghanistan? Was I supposed to answer that? Was that a rhetorical question or what? Sandberg didn't seem to be waiting for an answer. It sounded like he'd slammed himself into his desk chair. It sounded like he was rocking himself back and forth, angrily, muttering, "Fucking crazy ass shit. Just whatever. All right, whatever. Sure. No fucking problem. God damn it." It sounded like, and I frowned, cringed, like Sandberg was rhythmically banging his head against something hard. "Sandberg," I yelled, "for God's sake, don't give yourself brain damage." The soft banging stopped. The loft was totally silent for a moment, except for the hum of the refrigerator and our two heartbeats, and the dripping water tap in the bathroom, and Sandberg's slightly labored breathing. And then Sandberg took a deep breath and gave a long, frustrated yell. Face it, the kid had a way with words. The French doors banged open again, and suddenly Sandberg was standing there, looking pale and twitchy and awful. "You do know what the fuck this means, don't you? I mean, you've thought it out." Sandberg actually looked like he wanted an answer on this one, but I had none to give him. "Sandberg, I don't know what to say. I can't explain. I'm so fucking sorry." Sandberg's face tightened. "Not that. I don't mean that. I don't want your freaking apology. Of course you can't explain it. I can't explain it either. That's the goddamn point." I was at a total loss for words. What does it make us? Sandberg ran a nervous hand over his hair. He was actually shaking now. "You and me, like, what are we? Pawns of the goddamn universe?" He stumbled over to the sofa, collapsed heavily onto it, looking more freaked out than I'd ever seen him. "'Cause you gotta understand, Jim, I—' And Sandberg was staring out into the space ahead of him, not even seeing me. "I came to Cascade looking for you. Him. Whatever." I turned in my chair so that I could see Sandberg's face. "I'll make it worse," I said quietly. I went to Peru to run away from you, him, whatever. Sandberg looked deeply pained. Oh, fuck. Fuck, Jim, that's just so fucked up. So wrong. And Sandberg was still talking pretty coherently, but tears were suddenly streaming down his face. Terrifyingly, he didn't seem to notice. It's just, it can't possibly be a coincidence. And what the fuck does that mean? I couldn't help myself. Maybe it was wrong, and maybe I had no right. But I got up and went to Sandberg. Maybe I was just compounding my crimes, but Sandberg looked very much like he was having a nervous breakdown, right there on the sofa. I sank into the sofa next to him and pulled Sandberg into my arms. I would have understood if he'd punched me or flinched away, and part of me was expecting it. But Sandberg just leaned against me, let out one heaving, snotty gasp against my shoulder and moaned softly. Oh man, what a fucking day. It was like slipping into the wet, warm time stream, moving slowly through our infinite loop. Holding Sandberg in my arms, muttering nonsense comfort words that came straight from my subconscious, feeling my insides shatter and melt, while my cock and nipples grew rock hard under my clothes. It was dizzyingly familiar, and maybe for Sandberg too, because he snaked one arm around my neck and sort of stiffened slightly. It occurred to me that he was maybe testing the waters, or testing his feelings for me, because hell, at least I'd been an adult. Blair had only been 10 or so. When Sandberg lifted his head off my shoulder, his face looked terrifyingly intense. I flinched, surprised by the sudden blaze of fury. But a moment later, I realized that it wasn't anger. Sandberg was maybe just trying to map my face, to compare it to the one in his memory. Doing the same sort of point-by-point analysis I'd been sneakily doing all day and had finished over dinner. Eyes, shape of face, ears, mouth. Finally, Sandberg sighed and said, "You were blonde. You wore glasses." "Yes," I admitted. "They weren't real glasses. They were only..." Sandberg blurred forward and kissed me, and something deep inside of me exploded into flames. I shoved him hard against the sofa back and ravaged his sweet mouth, then kissed his cheeks, his eyelids, his forehead. Finally, I dropped my lips to his throat and sucked hungrily at the skin there, which grew red and ragged under my mouth. The time stream moved on, and I felt Sandberg's hand awkwardly groping at the fly of my pants, tugging down my zipper, curling around me. I gasped and gripped the back of his hand and used it to touch myself. Yesterday, today, tomorrow. The slipstream swirled around me and I drowned in it. The best moment of my life. The worst moment of my life. The feel of that small, warm hand sandwiched between my palm and my cock, stroking me. It had dwarfed everything else in my life up until this very second. Sandberg's hand slid down to the root of me, briefly pausing to cup and stroke my balls. His other hand touched the back of my head, caressed it, then pulled it into the sweaty juncture between his neck and shoulder. That was when I realized I was crying, and despite the knowledge, I couldn't stop. I just sobbed wetly into Sandberg's neck and thrust helplessly into his now slick hand, and came and came and came. I remembered this feeling too. I totally lost it the first time, feeling like I'd fractured into a million pieces, feeling like half of them had blown away in the whirlwind. Feeling like I'd never be whole again. I felt that way now, too. Felt just too damn much. Sensory overload. I remembered breaking down, feeling the boy's sticky hand on my cheek. Except Blair wasn't a boy anymore. Blair was a man, and the hand cupping my jaw was sure and adult. He lifted my head and turned it and kissed me, his tongue sliding heavily into my mouth, his kiss a clear sign of intent. He could do whatever he wanted with me. He was hard now, too. He moved on me, pushing me back, deepening the kiss with his tongue. I leaned back and let him, offering him anything, everything. I could hear his heart pounding. I could feel his still-trapped cock rubbing hard against my stomach as he crawled on top of me, as he pushed me down. His hands were roving over my body, then tightening on me. His heart was thundering in his chest. Blair lifted his mouth off of mine and muttered, "I want to fuck you." Fear, exhilaration, panic. I don't. I've never. Blair, looking hypnotized, leaned forward and slowly dragged the tip of his tongue across my jaw. "I won't hurt you," he murmured, and licked a circle around my ear. "Let me." "Yes," I heard myself say before I even made up my mind. Something wound tight inside of me was relaxing, releasing, and I knew suddenly that I'd let Blair Sandberg do anything to me. Anything. "Hey, Jim, do you mind if I tie you up in the living room and set you on fire?" Well, yeah, sure, okay. Blair's hands were on my shirt now, gripping tightly, hauling me up off the sofa, and pushing me through the French doors into his bedroom. Quickly, efficiently, Sandberg stripped us out of the rest of our clothes, and then he pushed me down the bed and crawled on top of me, blissful, that first slide of bare skin against bare skin. Blair firmly maneuvered me onto my side and began tongue-fucking my mouth. Lost in the feel of his hot, wet tongue inside me, I didn't really notice that his other hand had skated over my hip and was now stroking my ass. When I did notice, it was already too late. Slick fingers were already sliding between my cheeks. Involuntarily, I stiffened a little, not used to the damn indignity of it. But I was helpless to resist. I'd give him anything he wanted. His fingertips skating my asshole felt intrusive, embarrassing. I took a deep breath and tried to focus my sensory awareness entirely on Blair's beautiful mouth, my old familiar love. Still, I felt the shock of discomfort as he broached me, shoving his finger in. I tensed, shuddered, and then breathed a deep sigh of relief into Blair's mouth. The deeper he worked into me, the more I relaxed. I found that I liked having him inside me, having his tongue and finger inside me. It felt completing, fulfilling, my other half clicking neatly into place. I shivered as he carefully stretched me, and it felt right that he should be inside me this way. Right that his fingers should be buried so deep that my mouth should be full of his tongue. He was right to put his body into mine. Slowly, he began to work his fingers in and out of me, moving in rhythm with his mobile tongue, with the rhythm of his hips as he shoved his cock hard against my abdomen. I began to moan softly as he fucked me, faster and faster, fingers touching some place deep inside of me that sent bursts of ecstasy through my body. I found myself shuddering helplessly, and I had to pull my mouth away from his and turn my head because I suddenly couldn't breathe. I was dying. I was well and truly conquered, and Blair's heartbeat suddenly spiked and then thundered furiously. He blurted softly, "I'm not gonna make it, not gonna..." And I could hear the rapidly changing syncopation inside of him. I clutched him tightly to my chest just as he seized, shuddering and exploding violently, his cock pulsing torrents of wetness onto my body. "Can't hold it," Blair moaned into my shoulder, and he was weeping again, which almost seemed funny. Except I knew that he wasn't crying over his ability to maintain his erection until penetration, or not entirely about that, but about everything. Working hard all day, finding your entire life has been damn near predestined, learning that your best friend had molested you in an Afghani drug dealer's vault 19 years ago. It was a lot to process in a single damn day. I held him as tightly as I could and kissed his head up near the hairline. This time, the comforting words that bubbled up from my subconscious were, "Blair, I love you. I love you so much. You own me." "No," Blair murmured, biting lightly at my jaw. A sign of affection, I thought. "You own me. You are my blessed protector first. Before Lash. Before the garbage truck. Before Cascade. Before everything." "Or maybe," Blair added sleepily, "there's something larger that owns us both. You and me together. Maybe the sentinel thing owns us much more than we own it." Maybe that was true. Maybe the sentinel thing owned us both, and our attempts to own it, to control it, were just an illusion. But if it meant that I wasn't going to have to face life alone, that the universe would keep me circling back to Blair, perpetually circling around Blair, who was both the cause and the solution to my problems, the source of the void within me, and the completer. Well then, what the fuck did it matter? I mouthed his hair gently, imprinting the taste of him on my tongue. "Do you love me?" I whispered. "Could you possibly love me after this mess?" Blair made a small, anguished sound. "Jim, I loved you before I even knew you. I loved you when I thought you were someone else." His hand was slowly stroking my side again, making my skin tingle and my blood burn. And then he clutched tightly at my hip and held on. I felt him everywhere. No ghost now, but warm and solid against me. Two of a kind, Blair and me. Now and then. Different but similar. Separated by time and continents. Brought together by what? Grapes and olives, olives and grapes. In the haze of my memory, they look just the same. That was The End of the Fire by Francesca.